Okay, anyways, hope everybody's well. It's almost 8:31 when Mark likes to start. So before Hakad, I just want to welcome everybody. I want to thank the Sulzbachs, Jules and Carl Sulzbachs for sponsoring this evening's talk by Dr. Mark in observance of Jules' father's Yortzeit, upcoming Yortzeit and Yud Beit. David, Rav Yaakov, Ben Achava, Rav Yitzchak, Jacob Sulbach, you should have good memories. The Neshama should have Aliyah and long life and good health for all of us, and should be well. And thank you. Okay, Dr. Mark, it's all yours.
Okay, yes, and to the Sulzbachs, thank you very much for that. Really, Rabbi Kelman knows me too well, but I shouldn't have said the last class today is the last one, because as I'm preparing this morning, I see it's not the last one. It's definitely not the last one.
Baruch Hashem, I say that as a compliment. I told Mark yesterday that I took a bet on after Rabbi Liebtag's class yesterday that it won't be the last one.
That's the beauty of these classes, because right. There's no, I could make it the last one, but then you'll miss out.
Oh, Baruch Hashem, it's the Seder. We're in no rush. Nobody's going anywhere for better or for worse.
And the problem is, problem or not the problem, is that most of the stuff I say in the class, as you know, it's sort of tangents off the top of my head, but that's okay. But I do want to spend a good deal of time now with some comments, point out some things to you, and then we'll return, but especially something very interesting I want to show you. But first, let me share my screen, just the article I mentioned last class. Those who want to Google it, you can Google it here. It's from Tablet. Is a Jesuit good for the Jews? I referred to that last class, so you could look at that. The other thing is, the thing about Seirim, those who wanted to see the sources, you can Google this, Engage Couples Seirim and More, and you can read about that. So let me put that away. The next thing is that I listened to the class again, and here we have Rabbi Greenwald's book, Kobo Alavegos. The thing we saw last class, where he criticizes the funeral of a Rav Gaon Mefursam, a great rabbi who died in Brooklyn on Friday, and they buried him on Sunday. And we said it's definitely Rav Dovid Leibowitz, because that's December 7th, 1941. By the way, we should have acknowledged that last week. Today is the 13th. Last week it was on the 6th. We should have acknowledged Pearl Harbor Day. 80 years. But he says that they didn't wait for his sons and daughters or relatives. I'm not sure. I think you need to see someone has to send me from the Morgan Journal. I believe, as far as I know, that Rav Dovid Leibowitz had one son, namely Rav Henoch Leibowitz. I don't think he had any daughters. And as far as I know, Rav Henoch Leibowitz was at the funeral. So, not sure what that's about. Here, incidentally, is a picture of Rav Dovid Leibowitz, who's over here on the right. You can see him. He established a yeshiva called Chavetz Chaim. That's his son at the bottom. And on the left there, where my cursor is on, that's Rav Chaim Pinchas Scheinberg. Rav Chaim Pinchas Scheinberg, who's known as a gaon in Shas and Poskim, he was the Mashkiach Ruchani at this yeshiva. Not usual. You don't usually think of a Mashkiach Ruchani to be a great scholar in Shas and Poskim, but he was. You notice also that you don't see him in his later years. He used to wear, I don't know how many pairs of tzitzit, 20 or so. You can see pictures. It's his shoulders, and they're very high up, because he used to wear many pairs of tzitzis, maybe more than that. You see he's not wearing it in this picture here. Also, notice again the musmachim. You saw this from Skokie wearing tuxedos. Incidentally, I heard, I don't know if it's true, someone needs to investigate this. He was at Tarvadas, and there was a dispute. Someone told me that Rav Dovid Leibowitz was a big leftist, like almost a communist, and that created problems. But I haven't found any evidence of that. But that apparently is the story. He died young, unfortunately, only 54 years old. I mentioned, I heard also in the class, I said that I wasn't sure whether Rav Soloveitchik actually lived under the communists as Lieberman did. He did. I checked it today. In Chaslovich, he lived, Ramosha Soloveitchik left in 1921, so it was under the communists then. Also, thank you to David for emailing me that Lieberman's city, Motol, that Chaim Weizmann also came from there. Yeah, that's mentioned right at the beginning of the Spiro book. Surprised no one corrected me for that. I said that both in Targum Sheni and Midrash, the story of Haman, that he says to Achashverosh, if the fly goes in your the wine of the Jew, they'll take out the fly and drink it. But if you touch it, they won't drink it. That actually just is in the Gemara, too. It's in Maseches Megillah, Yud Gimel Amud Beis. So where are all the Bikim and Shas to point that out? I mentioned last class about the word Chanukiah, that it's a modern Hebrew word. Ian points out, and this comes from the rabbi of Turkey, the Chabad rabbi, Rabbi Chitrik, I think he pronounces it that way, that there's actually in Ladino, they would also say Chanukiah, they would spell it with a kuf. But I don't think, and I've looked around and all I've seen, I don't think there's any connection between that, despite what Rabbi Chitrik says, and modern Hebrew. I think, I don't think there's any connection at all. In Ladino, because like Spanish, they had the vowel at the end. So instead of Chanukah, remember I told you that Chanukah is also the name of the menorah? So they called it like Chanukiah, that sort of thing. I don't think there's any connection whatsoever, but Rabbi Chitrik insists that everyone who says that it's not authentic term, it wasn't invented, he thinks, by the modern Hebraists. Right at the end of the class, we're talking about the relationship of Lieberman and Heschel. And someone mentioned this book by Edward Kaplan called Spiritual Radical, that as an example of the maybe the difficult relationship when Heschel gave Lieberman a copy of his book on Torah Mesinai, that which deals with Rabbi Shmo and Rabbi Akiva, that he reports here on page 209 that Lieberman gave it back to him, saying, "Well, it's a nice volume, but another scholar already did this." And I pointed out that he must be referring to Arthur Marmorstein. Arthur Marmorstein wrote a book called The Image of God, I think, in rabbinic literature, in which he focuses on Rabbi Shmo and Rabbi Akiva. But no, he doesn't say it here. In the book, he said there was a nice volume. Sorry, there's a book written by this great Hungarian scholar, Wilhelm Bacher. I have to say, I don't know what book. Maybe this is a mistake. Maybe this comes from Wolf Kelman. And maybe Wolf Kelman, Rabbi Kelman's uncle, got it wrong here, because I don't know what Bacher has to say in particular. Bacher was a great scholar and said a lot of things, but I wouldn't be surprised that, unless someone can give me the exact source of Bacher, that it was Marmorstein. Now, this book, Spiritual Radical, really tries to play up the difficult relationships between Heschel and Lieberman. And I think it's really an exaggeration here. Let's say that Heschel wasn't Lieberman's cup of tea. However, they would take walks. They lived in the same buildings. Susanna Heschel would go to Lieberman to make it seem like they were enemies, or that Lieberman had complete contempt. That's really going too far. Obviously, Lieberman wasn't interested in the things Heschel was. In fact, in this book, Spiritual Radical, by Edward Kaplan from Brandeis University, he says that on page 110, he attributes the tension by personality conflicts largely the result of professional jealousy. So he's saying that Lieberman is jealous of the fame that Heschel was getting. I don't accept this. So furthermore, if you look on the note here, page 412, in discussing the difficulty, he says as follows. In the text on page 112, hold on. On page 412, note 46. So that's referring to 128. Let me read you what he says in the book, and then you'll see his source he's citing for this. It's on page 130, We can leave that out. On page 412, note 46, they say, see Shochet and Spiro, pages 223 to 228 on Lieberman's dark side. So you're supposed to think that Lieberman had this terrible dark side. But if you open up Shochet and Spiro here, that's not what they talk about at all. They don't refer to this terrible dark side. On the contrary, they're talking about how he's complicated, and he had a mischievous side as a youth, and the role of Musser, the relationship that he had to Chassidut a little as a child, you know, how he wasn't into that. And, he found out that Ratzadok is in the family, but no dark side, as if there's some, evil element here. So I want to correct the Kaplan book in that respect. They do say on page, something interesting, which I should mention, on page 110, it's talking about the relationship of the Heschels and how the Heschels would come. For example, in 1948, they came for 3 weeks in Martha's Vineyard. And it says here, as a personal favor, Lieberman made halachic adjustments to Sylvia, that is Sylvia Heschel's Sabbath observance, to enable her to use the elevator and to practice the piano by using a silent keyboard. Again, I would say it's not it's not a personal favor. When Lieberman's giving a psak, he's not doing it as a personal favor. Obviously, Heschel, they asked about the elevator, the old question, can you open an elevator? How many floors does it have to be for you to take advantage of the elevator man? They used to have elevator men. I think Rav Soloveitchik held if it was over the fourth floor, you could use it, or maybe it was the fifth floor. So Lieberman clearly told her that whatever floor she was on, she could use it. They were in the same building, and told her that she could use some sort of keyboard. It didn't make any sounds if she wanted to play around to practice her piano. But it's not a personal favor. Let me just say that. Now, in terms of the Martha's Vineyard, I should also mention something else. Just because it reminded me when I saw it that in Spiro and Shochet on page 178, it has something also relevant to Martha's Vineyard. That's where they would they had a summer house that Finkelsteins would come and visit. And Louis Finkelstein, the chancellor of the seminary, refused to allow his children to swim during the 9 days. So it describes here that, and you have a letter here from Lieberman writing to Finkelstein, in which he says, Mrs. Lieberman, that is, he's giving the responsibility of the heter to his wife. Mrs. Lieberman contends that the prohibition of bathing during the 9 days before the fast of Tisha B'Av does not apply to the country, since it is not pleasure bathing, but natural escape from the heat. She maintains, therefore, that there is no good reason for Mooney to postpone the visit till after Tisha B'Av, and meanwhile be roasted in the heat of New York. The story here is that they would, when they didn't want to come out to Martha's Vineyard because Louis Finkelstein did not allow his children to go swimming in the 9 days. And what Lieberman said is, the kids can go swimming. It's not bathing. It's just cooling off. And notice he said, I don't know if it's true or it's just his cute way of saying it, that this is his wife's suggestion. Now, any of us who've been to camp know all about this. We don't have, normally in camp, you have two swims. You have instructional swim and then you have free swim. So during the 9 days, they have two instructional swims. And that's exactly what Lieberman was saying, that if you're not in there for the pleasure, you're just doing it to cool off. Instructional swim is you're actually learning how to swim, but it's the same thing, just cooling off. It's opposed to pleasure. Really, this whole thing of not swimming in the 9 days is problematic. Let me just mention first the Brisker perspective, or at least Rabbi Soloveitchik's perspective. When I was in Camp Morasha, I still remember it, they called up the Rav, and the Rav told them that you can go swimming every day until Tisha B'Av, but not on Tisha B'Av, of course, and that his grandfather went swimming Erev Tisha B'Av. Now, I don't think his grandfather went swimming, and I think he was just saying it to stress the point. If you look in Nefesh HaRav, though, there is the sheet of the Rav, and there it's attributed to Rav Moshe, not Rav Chaim, was that they held that there is no issue of bathing at all in the 9 days. That although this is the Minhag Yisrael, that they held that this was not an issue. even if you leave that aside, I never understood this business. I mean, my kids also went to camp, so they only have instructional swim. But the Minhag is about bathing. The Minhag is bathing as for pleasure, that sort of thing. Going in the water to cool off clearly doesn't fall in that category. And why do kids go in the water? They go to water to have fun, like they're having fun playing basketball. What does this have to do with bathing? I don't understand why that ever became an issue at all. We understand what bathing is. You're in a sauna, you're relaxing, you know, you're like you're Herod or something. But what does this have to do with going swimming, either for relaxation or for any reason, unless you happen to bathe, that's your bath. I don't know, but this is now like one of the standard orthodox things, that it's only instructional swim, not free swim. The last thing I want to mention, and I'm going to go like 3 or 4 minutes longer, because this is, I think, important. In preparing to introduce the issue of the women's issue, the women's ordination, I wanted to get a sense of what the conversations were in the conservative movement before the 70s. I'll tell you about what happens in the 70s and what the pressure that is exerted by congregants and rabbis around the country. But I was curious to know what was going on before the 60s. Of course, you had women in Minyan in many conservative synagogues. You had pressure for women to have aliyahs. So I picked up last week this book. It's a 3-volume book, Proceedings of the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards of the Conservative Movement, 1927-1970, edited by Rabbi David Glinkin. What he did, this is in 3 volumes, I'm only in the first volume here. What Rabbi David Glinkin did was to go through all the proceedings of the Rabbinical Assembly. Anything that discusses their Jewish law, he pulled it out, and also reports to the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards, and he put it in this nice volume. There, to this day, we do not have a study. This is it's got to be someone's doctoral dissertation one day, or a book, a study of the history and also theology of conservative halacha, conservative psak. And these books, unfortunately, they're not in print. I wanted to see if I can get myself one. Or at least I couldn't find it. You want to, if you want to study this, these are essential writings. And, there's a lot of interesting things I can call your attention to. Incidentally, on page 110, we see, I didn't even know this, I would have mentioned this when we dealt with the Epstein proposal, that Louis Ginsburg was opposed to Louis Epstein's proposal of his conditional marriage that we spoke about. And the reason Ginsburg gives, this is from 1939, is because if you don't get the East European rabbis on board, this is no good. We can't split the Jewish people. Then I saw throughout these the early reports that Rabbi Samuel Rosenblatt, that's Yossel Rosenblatt's son, but he was a rabbi in Baltimore for many years. I knew he was a member of the Rabbinical Assembly. He's also a musmach of the seminary, but then he got Orthodox smicha. But he was on the Committee of Jewish Law and Standards at the same time that he's rabbi of an Orthodox shul. That shows you the what we spoke about in your early courses, how the difference between Orthodox and conservative, not so pashut, as we'd say in yeshiva. On page 123, I'm surprised to see that they're dealing with the organ. This is from 1940, and 27 conservative synagogues have organs, of which 13 use it for services, 14 play it for special occasions. But of the rabbis in the Rabbinical Assembly, 35 rabbis, they said that they are in favor of an organ. 30 are neutral and 30 are opposed. You have conservative synagogues with an organ. On page 488, you see from 1961, an absolute unanimous ruling by the Committee of Jewish Law and Standards. No Christians, or non-Jews, I should say, but it says here Christians in a synagogue choir. We spoke about that. On page 570, very interesting, that Rabbi Leon Fink, he writes about, in terms of conservative movement, and they have to be make new, steps, to take new steps to deal with the reality. He tells us that he has a new halacha, that when there's a family is sitting Shiva and the Shiva expires on Shabbos, he tells them that they have to sit Shiva 2 hours after Shabbos. even though that's not the halacha. In other words, he lies to them. But it says the reason is because he doesn't use the word lie. In my book, Changing the Immutable, I quote an Orthodox posek who says that the halacha is you should tell people who are not Shomer Shabbos and are going to go to work that they still have to stay home and sit Shiva. Even though they don't, there's no Shiva on Shabbos. He doesn't say he lies, or I think he has the same conclusion basically, but he says that for America, we need a different type of Shiva. And they're all going to go to work unless we tell them that they have to do Shiva. I guess it's a form of lying. On page 572, he also talks about how part of the problem is that we're stuck in the past. And the example he gives is that in his shul, the first Ola that got an Aliyah wanted a Misha Berach for his son in Vietnam. This is 68. And he says, I don't have a prayer. He says, the next person just came back from a cruise and they said Birkas HaGomel. And he was saying how crazy this is that we have a Birkas HaGomel, but what about a Misha Berach for a son in Vietnam? And on page 577, he talks about Rabbi Joel Klein. Maybe Rabbi should know, knows him. I'm surprised they included this in here. He says, we spent the whole weekend talking about how we have to make the synagogue service something meaningful to people. And he says, this morning I attended services here at the weekday minion. And with great honesty, I can tell you that I never attended a dead service like the one we had this morning. So here Rabbi Fink is saying that we want the people to have a positive service. Our synagogue's a dead service. 581, you see Rabbi Benjamin Kreitman disagreeing with Rav Soloveitchik on what does it mean to be a halachic man? And he asks, who is closer to the letter and spirit of the Talmud, the halachic man of Rabbi Soloveitchik or the halachic man of Professor Ginsburg? So this is all very interesting, but this is not what I want to share with you. What I want to share with you now, and this will be the last thing we do before we pick up, is I think it says it all in terms of the failures of the conservative movement. What you're going to see right now. And look, it's, this what I'm going to read you is from 1959. If you're in 1959, you're assuming the future is the conservative movement. But let me read you something here. This is from the Committee of Jewish Law and Standards. It's from 1959, page 468. And this is what they conclude. And this was adopted unanimously. The Committee on Jewish Law and Standards has a strange situation that you can have two rulings, the majority and the minority, and each are valid. But this is unanimous. Everyone agrees with this. It's dealing with someone who's an avel, the mourner. And of course, we know we have to do kriya, rip the garment. This is what the conservative official halachic authorities said in 59. The rite of kriya is well-grounded in Jewish literature, rite, and practice. It is not only compatible with the mourner's needs for giving vent to his feelings, but also helps him release suppressed emotions by physical means. The mores of our day do not always permit resorting to methods of performing kriya, which were employed in previous generations. Therefore, we recognize kriya with a ribbon as a valid kriya. You know, the little ribbon they have that you do a little cut, which that you can go in and that identifies, I guess, who's the mourner is. Now, just think of what they did here. We spoke about driving a shul on Shabbos. We know why the conservative movement came up with this response of permitting driving a shul on Shabbos. Because if the people live far away, they can't go to shul on Shabbos. What's the Jewish life going to be like? So that's a big issue. We spoke about the Aguna issue, the Epstein proposal and other proposals. Those are big issues. So we see why the conservative movement felt like they had to make major changes. Here we have, on the scheme of things, a small issue, kriya. And yet, what do they say? The mores of our day do not permit resorting to this. What do you mean the mores of our day? Is that what Judaism is supposed to be about? If Chesterton had seen this, Chesterton's book, Orthodoxy, what he would have a good word to say about this, the way he criticized the people in his day of how they would try to make Christianity amenable to the mores of their day. So you're altering Jewish practice, not because people need to come to shul on Shabbos, not because aguna issues, big things. The mores of the day, people are embarrassed. They feel weird when non-Jews come over or non-religious people that they did kriya. So therefore, we're going to do it with a ribbon. How the conservative, is this Salman Schechter? Is this Zacharia Frankel? The mores, we're now going to listen because it doesn't look good in America. It looks primitive, just like how the reason Scholz got rid of Birkas Kohanim. So that to me is a sign of a real failure. The mores. We know this was a big issue, even in the Orthodox world. If you look in Maurice Lamb's book, he writes, he has on page 42, he deals with should a pinned ribbon be used? And he talks about how shallow, how disappointing, how pitiably trivial, therefore, to symbolize these authentic sentiments, not by an act of historic and religious significance, but by the little black ribbon or button invented by enterprising American undertakers. Tradition calls upon us to tear our garments, to put the mark of the broken heart on our own clothing, and not to vent our feelings on a meaningless and impersonal strip of cloth pinned on us by a stranger. This is actually the Sridi Eish, Rabbi Yochai Yaakov Weinberg deals with this as well in volume 2, number 121. And he was asked by the chief rabbi of Chile, Rabbi Greenwald, is it worth protesting when people use this little ribbon? And Rabbi Weinberg says, if they're not going to listen, at least let them cut the ribbon, because at least they won't forget the idea of Kriya. But you have to tell them in a nice way, he says, that this isn't the obligation. And so the conservative movement could have said that, of course, you have to do Kriya. If people don't want to do it, if they think it's primitive, well, then fine, then they won't do it. But to give a heter, to tell them that for the rabbis to acknowledge and give an imprimatur to the fact that the masses feel that it's primitive, that's I think that says a lot as to the problems we see already in the movement. Now, we're picking up with where we were last class. The last thing I showed you was, one second here. Where were we? Yes, we're dealing with Jacob Neusner. In this article, which I encourage everyone to read, if you're interested, by Shaul Magid. Shaul Magid has really become a real leading public intellectual in the Jewish world. You might not like some of his politics, but he's extremely prolific. But he says that Aaron Hughes in this book, he quotes him that Neusner may be the most important American-born Jewish thinker this country has produced. And Magid says it is a huge claim for sure, and therefore contestable, but upon reflection is actually quite reasonable. And so Magid writes explaining why Neusner is so significant. And remember, in addition to all the Talmudic stuff, Neusner wrote about American Judaism, about the universities, all these sorts of things. He wrote about theology. He corresponded with Pope Benedict about Judaism and Christianity. What I want to, we're going to discuss a bit now, I told you, is this essay, the essay of Lieberman, A Tragedy or a Comedy, the review article. I introduced it briefly last class. If you look in Aaron Hughes's book, and I saw this myself when I went to the Lieberman archive, you have these fawning letters of Neusner to Lieberman, but he quotes on page 45, Neusner writing in 1981. The letters I saw were even earlier. He says, I am enjoying HaYerushalmi Kivshuto so much that I wanted to tell you. It reminds me of why I have long ago concluded that you are the greatest exegete of rabbinic texts of the 20th century and among the true greats, among the ones I have studied and used of all time. So here you have Neusner telling Lieberman he's one of the greatest scholars of all time, the greatest Talmudists. That would certainly change. Incidentally, on this page, also page 45, it quotes a letter of to Neusner from Rabbi Mandelbaum, Bernard Mandelbaum, who we've spoken about before. He's the one that we showed the video of him with the Babich Rebbe, who suggested that Lieberman penned the nasty review as a way of getting back at Neusner because of a nasty footnote about Ginsburg and Finkelstein in an article that Neusner had published. I don't know. What I will tell you is as follows. Neusner publishes his translation of the Jerusalem Talmud single-handedly. There's another single-handed translation also, Heinrich Guggenheimer. If you go on Safaria, you see a translation there of Yerushalmi, complete with scholarly footnotes. He was not a Talmudist, Guggenheimer. I was in this email conversation this week with his son. He has a son in New York, he has a son in Israel. He didn't even have a yeshiva background. He's a complete autodidact. And what a genius. He's a mathematician. He also wrote a book on the Hebrew language. He wrote a book called The Scholar's Haggadah. This is not his main thing. He's a mathematician. And then he translated himself the entire Yerushalmi. And it's a much more scholarly edition than the Neusner edition. But here, I also stand in awe of Guggenheimer. If anyone knew him, he only passed away a few years ago. But Neusner wrote this translation. And for whatever reason, why Lieberman decided to trash it the way he did, it could be that Lieberman looked out and saw that that Neusner was becoming famous and was being taken in the academic world, that is the Western academic world, the university world, as opposed to the seminary world. He was being taken as the authority on the Talmud, that Lieberman thought he had to set the world right. We've had other examples of reviewers who feel this way. What is the review? Well, it appeared in the Journal of the American Oriental Society. It appeared posthumously. The first few pages are just examples of how Neusner totally missed the translation. And then he says as follows. I'll read to you what he says. As I have previously stated, I have presented only a few examples of our translator's learning, and I conclude with a clear conscience. The right place for our English translation is the wastebasket. A preliminary translation is not a mockery translation, not a farce of an important ancient document. In fairness to the translator, I must add that his various essays on Jewish topics are meritorious. They abound in brilliant insights and intelligent questions. In the beginning, when he was well aware of his ignorance of the original languages, he relied on responsible English translations of rabbinic texts, like those of the Sansino Press. Later, however, he began to make his own translation of rabbinic sources. Whenever the translator deviates from the accepted English translation already available, his renderings are all more or less of the same character. Our present translation is the crown of them all. So you can't get any sharper than this. It's the only place for it is the wastebasket. And it's not like this just came out and then was forgotten. Neusner, you can read all about in Hughes, he threatened to sue the Journal of the American Oriental Society. There's a scholar, Morton Smith. He's also a problematic character because he seems to have forged this gospel, this so-called gospel, which was supposedly found in one of the monasteries in Israel. In Israel or Sinai, I forget now, and it seems that it was completely made up by him, and Jesus has all sorts of strange sexual tendencies in this. And leave that aside, although this Neusner will use this, because famously, at the gathering of, I think it was the American Academy of Religion, let's see, he must mention it, obviously, this is mentioned. The whole story is mentioned by Hughes. But on page one, the Society of Biblical Literature, 1984, Neusner's on a panel, and Morton Smith, right after Neusner speaks, he has these two big shopping bags, and he starts handing out to everyone there copies of Lieberman's review, while Neusner is up there on the dais. And what does he say? He says on page 195, he said as follows, or at least he wrote in the Biblical Archaeology Review this. His words were not the exact same of the time, but he says, I must warn you, this is Morton Smith, that his translation of the Palestinian Talmud contains many serious mistakes. It is a serious misfortune for Jewish studies. And he goes on and on. In Lieberman's words, the place for this translation is the wastebasket. Morton Smith is not Jewish. He was in Jerusalem in the 40s. He said he got a Hebrew PhD at the Hebrew University in Hebrew. So I know Hebrew backwards and forwards. I have brought Xerox copies of Lieberman's review, and these I shall now pass around in the hope that they may do something to diminish the coming crop of Neusnerisms. Look, it's one thing to publish strong reviews like that. We've had other strong reviews. I don't need to mention names, but if you're in Jewish studies, you know of certain strong reviews that have gone over the line. Is this going over the line? Perhaps. I think it's a little unfortunate that this is Lieberman's last review. And this is his posthumous parting shot, as it were. It would have been a lot better if it wasn't, and if Neusner then maybe could have replied. Instead, Neusner replied in an entire book called Why There Was Never a Talmud of Caesarea, Saul Lieberman's Mistakes. And he even includes here an article as an appendix by Professor Sarah Mandel. Did Saul Lieberman know Latin or Greek? And then he has an attack here on Morton Smith. I guess the Lieberman, Neusner got his revenge, and Neusner would again and again attack Lieberman, accuse Lieberman of just being a rabbi, someone at a seminary, not someone who could speak to the wider academic world. Neusner even reprinted the review essay that is Lieberman's criticism. He put it as an appendix to one of his Talmud translations to show that, okay, I make little mistakes. Everyone makes little mistakes, but it's the big things that are important. It is true that Neusner made many contributions. No one's going to say that he was obviously the level of Lieberman in terms of page after page of the Talmud. They really were focused in different areas. So I don't really want to say any more about that. I think it is unfortunate that it was Lieberman's, his last piece that many people, and everyone remembers that. He must have been very angry, obviously, and it led him to that. But I just, what can I say? Although many people enjoy reading slash and burn reviews like this, I guess like they enjoy watching NASCAR crashes. To me, it's never something that I enjoy. And at the end of the day, even if someone was just a difficult personality as Neusner, there's still, I don't know, Cavo de Brios issues, I should say. But be that as it may, for many people don't know much about Lieberman. They certainly know about his strong attack against Neusner, which then led to Neusner piling on against Lieberman for the next couple of decades. The last of the major issues I want to discuss, which will begin this class and we'll go into the next class, deals with the issue of the JTS and the Jewish Theological Seminary and women rabbis, which became such a big issue at the time. It wasn't an issue in the Orthodox world. I can still remember, many of us can still remember, the idea in the 80s that there'd be women Orthodox rabbis. It was incomprehensible. It was like the furthest thing imaginable. Look how much things have changed. But it is a very big problem in the Orthodox world. Let me begin by talking about some of the Orthodox world on this, because then we can appreciate, I think, better what's going on in the conservative world. If people say that what happens in the reform will happen in the conservative movement 30, 40 years later, you can understand why people who oppose the moves to women rabbis and orthodoxy will apply the same thing that what happens in the conservative movement, just wait 20, 30 years, you're going to have it in the Orthodox. But it's a little more complicated than that. So let me show you a few things. Let me open up our screens here. First is, when you deal with women rabbis, I've mentioned this before, but we have a lot of new people. So I just want to call your attention to something. In the Shema Gedolim of the Chidah, the great Rechaim Yosef David Azulai, you can't get much greater than the Chidah. He has a book called Shema Gedolim, which he records all the great rabbis who've lived until his day. He has a section there, after dealing with in letter R, Resh, called Rabbanit. And Rabbanit for the Chidah here does not mean Rebbetzin. What it means is a female rabbi. What does a rabbi mean? A rabbi doesn't mean smicha. A rabbi means one who's a Talmudic scholar. The Rambam never had smicha, but he was certainly a rabbi. And he brings examples of great women Torah scholars, and we know about them. We have examples of them throughout history. Let me show you a few other things as prefaces before we go. Who were the first women rabbis? Well, we have whole history here. Here's Pamela Nadel, women who would be rabbis. That is, who would be rabbis. Not all of them were rabbis. So, for instance, Ray Frank. I don't know if you've heard of Ray Frank. She never had smicha, but she was called a rabbi. You can read all about her. She'd preach. She'd preach all throughout the West. Here, she's called a woman rabbi, but she wasn't really. Then you have Regina Jonas. She was killed in Auschwitz, unfortunately, but she studied at the liberal, I guess we call it reform, rabbinical seminary in Berlin. And she wanted to get smicha there. She wrote a dissertation there about the women getting smicha. Can they get? And what happened was her, where is it? Yes, here it is. The chief Talmudic scholar at the Reform Rabbinical Seminary in Berlin, his name was Chanoch Albeck of the famous Albeck family. An Orthodox Jew from the famous Albeck family. His grandchildren, now you can find him in all the Haredi schools in yeshivas in Israel. I shouldn't say all of them, but Kol Torah, places like that. We spoke a good deal about the Albeck family in previous class when we dealt with the Albeck-Auerbach dispute over the Nachal Eshkol. But he, I don't know if the children today want to know about this, but he was, just like Lieberman was in the conservative institution, Albeck was in the Hochschule, the Reform Institution. But he refused to give smicha. He refused to sign ordination certificate for a woman. He was signing it for the men, but he wasn't signing it for the women. Later, however, she did get smicha. Max Dienemann, who was a leading Reform rabbi in Berlin, he gave her... was he in Berlin? No, I don't think he was in Berlin, actually. He gave her smicha. And she served as she was a chaplain, things like that. She wasn't a rabbi in a shul, though she would preach. And unfortunately, she was killed in the Holocaust. You can read about her. I think she was first deported to Theresienstadt. Now, why do I remember that also? Because I was in Prague a few years ago, and there was a whole group of conservative, reform, female rabbis, and also the Maharat, Sarah Hurwitz, was there as well. They were like retracing Regina Jonas's steps. Who else? What other names are important when we think of female ordination? Well, you have here, where is it? Here you have it. If you go to Wikipedia here, you have a timeline of women rabbis. And well, you'll see, have here Sally Priesand, ordained by HUC in 1972. Amy Eilberg, ordained by the seminary in 1985. And then you'll have on this list, have 2006, Dina Nyman, ordained by Rabbi Daniel Sperber, became the first woman to lead an Orthodox synagogue, Eivat Orach Eliezer, using the title Rosh Keilah. I can tell you that she was not, I don't know if she's ordained now. If it's here, I guess it's true, but she definitely had no ordination when she was appointed Rosh Keilah of that show. I know that show. I went to that show in the late 90s on the Upper West Side. She was learned, and she became head of the community, but she was not ordained. But if you continue on, you read about Hurwitz in 2009. Sarah Hurwitz was ordained. She was indeed ordained. This is at Rabbi Avi Weiss's institution, by Rabbi Sperber and Rabbi Avi Weiss, and they gave her the title Maharat, which later she took the title Rabbah. You can read on 2015, Lila Kagedin. Kagedin, thank you. Was also her in-laws came on my trip to Morocco 2 years ago. She was the first graduate of Shiva Maharat to use the title Rabbi. And he goes up to 2018. Dina Brower, born in Italy, became Britain's first female Orthodox rabbi. She chose the title Rabbah, the feminine form of rabbi. I've said this many times because this goes back to Sarah Hurwitz, Rabbah. Rabbah is not the feminine of rabbi. Rabbah is the feminine of Rav. Rabbi would be both men and women. So what's the Orthodox situation? Some people would say that these aren't Orthodox. Well, we have Rabbi Herzl Hefter. Rabbi Herzl Hefter, student of Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. He taught Yeridei Hashir at Gruss for many years. You can read from about 5-6 years ago his article, Why I Ordained Women. His yeshiva in Jerusalem also ordains women. You have, go to the, I found on the Times of Israel, there's an article. support for women clergy by denomination for the open Orthodox strongly support or somewhat support 24%. Liberal modern Orthodox, it's over 50%. I'm not sure the difference what modern Orthodox is versus centrist Orthodox. These are all self-characterizations. I don't know the difference between right centrist and centrist, but you can see here that among the liberal Orthodox, liberal modern Orthodox, there is a very strong support for ordination. And we're going to see in a few minutes, the Nagatsurin movement, you had the same sort of situation going on, very strong support. And even of like modern Orthodox mainstream, so they're showing like 30%. I don't know if it's a generational thing or not. So this is a big issue. Women's ordination. Should there be women rabbis in Orthodoxy? We'll reflect on this a little more after we see how it played out in the conservative movement. I want to show you, though, one more thing before we go back in time. It's become such a big issue, partly because, obviously, the changes. Women are now scholars in all sorts of areas. And people are wondering, well, are there any halachic issues here? What's the halachic issue? You have many young learned people who are saying they don't see the problem. If a woman could teach Talmud, if she could give talks, why can't she decide halacha questions for the community? Especially, we know the Sefer Achinuch says already in medieval times that a woman could decide halacha questions, and no one says she can't. So this is, it's already an issue in the American modern Orthodox community. There are OU synagogues, as we speak, that have women rabbis. None of them are the chief rabbi, the head rabbi. They're all assistant rabbis, but the National Synagogue in Washington, D.C., the rabbi just announced he's resigning because he's opening up a yeshiva in Washington, D.C., like a funky, interesting yeshiva. And someone sent me a news report from the Washington Post that the assistant rabbi, who's a woman, is now taking over as the rabbi. Now, the OU is against this. I'll read you what the OU says in a minute. It seems like it's like the situation with the Mechitza, that the shuls that are already members of the OU, they're being grandfathered in. But if an OU shul now were to do this, it might be controversial. And none of these shuls, these liberal Orthodox shuls, they don't need to join the OU. But the OU felt that they had to make a statement about this. It's so interesting because all the things we're going to see with the OU and we're seeing now, the conservatives dealt with this. And so many of the things that the conservatives were saying in favor of women rabbis, we see repeated by in liberal orthodoxy. But the OU a few years ago felt that they had to take a stand on this. And they brought together a group of rabbis. The document, which we're going to see now, is only signed by rabbis. There were a few women who were on the committee. But here are the questions that they were asked. One, is it halachically acceptable for a synagogue to employ a woman in a clergy function? That is, synagogues asked this to the Orthodox Union, and then they appointed these rabbis to study it. Two, what is the broadest spectrum of professional roles within a synagogue that may be performed by a woman? Of course, so we're going to have to figure out, what does it mean, clergy? What does that mean? And is it just, if you just read the questions here, you would think that there's no issue with the title rabbi. The issue is just the title of clergy. But I will show you in a second what they conclude. Before that, I want to give you an example, though. Those who've been with me for many, many months, over a year ago, you'll remember this, but we have a lot of new people. The so-called centrist YU, OU world has a problem, because they don't know what to do with all these learned women. They don't know what titles to give them. And we're going to see here, according to the OU, the very title rabbi is an issue. That's really what started, I think, all this. The Maharat wasn't such a problem. It's then he said, well, let's go to Rabbah as well. But let me give you an example of what I mean, show you. So here you have Yeshiva University, Community Beit Midrash. So you have two shiurim, one from Menachem Penner and the other from less than perfect leadership, the judges of Sefer Shoftim, Professor Nachama Price. Professor? As I've said before, professor is an academic term. Professor is a secular term. Professor is a university term. What does teaching Torah have to do with professor in a place like Yeshiva University? But they can't call her Rabbanit. They can't call her. So you have to call her professor. Here, a whole day of learning for women. So you have someone from Israel, Rabbanit. She gets the title Rabbanit. Rabbanit does not mean wife of a rabbi. It means female rabbi. But look at all the Americans, the YU people. Dean Shoshana Schechter. Here from even Shmichalah, she goes, Mrs. Schumacher, professor. And these are all Torah talks. These are not academic talks. When people think of a professor, they don't think of someone who just does traditional Torah learning. But YU doesn't have a term for them. Again, YU is women. Here, she's not even a professor. She's Mrs. Nechama Price. I hate to say it, you know, I'm a supporter of YU, but YU is so pathetic. They can't even come up with a title for learned women. They can't come up with anything to give them. You go over and over, women in Tanakh and Talmud, put on by YU, Rabbi Chaim Angel, Rabbi Shalom Carmi, Rabbi Daniel Feldman, Mrs. Nechama Price, Rabbi Mark Dratch, Rabbi Shmuel Hain, Dr. Aaron Kohler, Mrs. Shoshana Schechter, Mrs. Yael Leibovitz. And you can go on, Mrs. Not there's anything wrong with Mrs., but the point is, you see very clearly that there's an issue here. There's a problem here because we give titles in recognition of people who accomplish things. And the so-called centrist orthodoxy can't even come up with a proper title without Mrs. or Professor. There's no title for them because they're afraid. They're afraid of the slippery slope. They're afraid that you're going to call them Rabbanit, even though all the religious science institutions in Israel have the title Rabbanit. So that doesn't mean they're rabbis of shuls or anything, but at least it's a title. Now, if you look at the OU statement, it's interesting. The OU, it's a very interesting document. And in many ways, I think it's more honest, or honest is not the right word, more in line with the tradition than what we're going to see in the conservative documents, because in the conservative documents, they approach it as it's a halachic issue. And we'll see, for example, Rabbi Joel Roth and even Halivni, and they're trying to make halachic arguments. In this document, they really recognize this isn't a halachic issue as much as it's an issue of tradition, Masorah. And I think that's a much more authentic and honest way of looking at it. And they say right at the beginning that the issue, it touches not only on halacha, but on the fundamental issues in hashkafat olam, how you view the world. And really, halacha is not what's driving this. Anyone who reads the article carefully, let me read you the response, we can call it. Let me read you the conclusion here. And they say that... role models are important for women, 100%, but they have to be in a non-clergy capacity. Now, what's clergy? Well, clergy, they say that if you give a title to a woman that connotes the status of a clergy member, what is that? If women perform clergy functions on a regular, ongoing basis. So what are these? Officiating at religiously significant life cycle events, brit milah, baby naming, bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah. They point out if it's just a gathering of women, of course the woman could do it. Weddings and funerals. So for instance, they're saying that they're not saying you can never happen, but on an ongoing basis that a woman shouldn't get up and be in charge of a funeral, run a funeral or run a wedding. I mean, weddings, maybe they wouldn't want it at all, but the language they use, the ongoing practice. So you have, let's say, you have a family that's, they have a funeral, for example, far from any big communities, and the rabbi couldn't go there. So the woman, the educational director, she can run it. No one's going to think it's such a crazy thing. But as an ongoing thing, no. The regular practice of delivering sermons. Or presiding over a minyan. So you could deliver a sermon occasionally, but it can't be regular. Now, anyone who has any knowledge of halacha knows that this isn't how halacha operates. The idea that the woman could give a sermon occasionally, she could occasionally preside over a funeral, but she can't do it on a weekly basis. This is not the language of halacha. This is the language of tradition, of masorah, which is also valuable. But it's very different than what we'll see how the conservatives approach this. the conservatives approached it, that if there's nothing halachically wrong, then it's permissible. That is, if you can't show me that it's halachically forbidden, ergo, it's permissible. And Lieberman, I think, also falls into that same trap. He assumes that you have to argue halachically, and he really stretches things. He really goes out on a limb. The OU statement does not argue this. They recognize this isn't really halacha we're talking in a pure sense. So what does the OU conclude? What can women do? That is the men to say, for those who want to look at it cynically, the men declaring what women can do, that in a non-clergy capacity, and we've already seen what clergy is, that women can teach ongoing classes in shiurim and deliver lectures. And modern Orthodox synagogues all have this. Obviously, this isn't an issue for the Haredim, because the Haredim don't have women teaching giving shiurim to men. That's just impossible. It's impossible for two reasons. It's impossible because in the Haredi world, with certain exceptions, but generally in the Haredi world, you don't have women who are able to give, let's say, shiurim and halacha, things like that, because they don't study advanced Talmud. But even aside from that, if you have certain special women who know Talmud, the idea that you would give a shiur to men, that's clearly forbidden. So this is a modern Orthodox thing, and the modern Orthodox opened up the door to this because they gave women advanced educations, or Torah educations, and they went further, and they said that they could share this wisdom with the community at large, serving as a visiting scholar in residence. These scholars and residents give talks from the Bima, serving in senior managerial or administrative positions, such as executive director, director of programming, and or adult education. So a woman, they're saying, in a modern Orthodox shul, could be the executive director. She could run the education. She could be the senior educator, but because that's not clergy. Furthermore, they said that a woman could be a staff member in the role of community educator, institutional scholar, to supplement the rabbis. It's hard to know the difference here. Most rabbis, if you have a big shul, sometimes they have like three or four rabbis. The other rabbis, their job is just teaching. And I guess funerals, things like that. But here you have a woman that she could be employed. As long as she's not called, given the title, I guess, a clergy title, she could be an educator, she could serve as a staff member in the role of professional counselor, and she could serve as a teacher and mentor to guide females through the conversion process. And it goes on to say that this gives women a very big role without being clergy. I guess you'll have to, on your own, decide whether, what's the difference between a rabbi giving a sermon and deciding halacha and a community educator do that. But we see already how touchy this is. And most modern Orthodox shuls, they follow these rules. That is, they don't go the clergy route. Maybe over time, some of them will fall into it in terms of like the rabbi's not around, so the educator will do the funeral or even do the wedding, perhaps. What does a rabbi do at a wedding? He's sort of like a master of ceremonies. He doesn't have any halachic significance. The witnesses are the ones with the halachic significance. So in theory, it's not just in theory. Rav Shlomo Fischer, we mentioned, he gave permission at his granddaughter's wedding for a woman to have the last of the Sheva Brachos. And this is Rav Shlomo Fischer. This isn't open Orthodox here. But to show you how problematic this is, and we'll end with this, I guess. Remember I showed you this book a couple weeks ago, the Rabbi Buchenwald, The Life and Times of Rabbi Herschel Schachter? Just to show you how in the 70s and 80s, how big a deal this was. This is fucking 1986. Rabbi Schachter was on the Chaplaincy Commission. This is a big deal. This goes back to World War II, where the Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform agreed to come together to have the chaplains to work, so the chaplains would go through them, and they'd work for the servicemen. The problem was, in 1986, Reform woman rabbi, Julie Schwartz, she wanted to be a chaplain. And when you think about it, that's like the least halakhically objectionable thing. I don't even see how in the OU statement, if a woman wants to be at a hospital, or be at an army base, she might be running services, but just visit people at a hospital, how that would be regarded as clergy. That's like a job of social work, giving spiritual counseling. That seems to me would fall, be okay under the OU. But the problem was the Orthodox had a fit because the Orthodox said we cannot allow a woman rabbi in the chaplaincy, even though it's coming from the Reform. And they threatened to withdraw, including Rabbi Schachter, to withdraw the Orthodox from this. And Rabbi Louis Bernstein explained that, you know, because he was challenged then, you're already together with the Reform. And he said, no, but the Rosh Yeshiva even agreed that this was okay to do. But Schachter points, not Schachter, Madoff points out on page 391, something which today we take for granted, and I think would be obvious, but at the time they didn't. Listen to this. Why were they able, why was the Orthodox able to be in a joint commission with Reform rabbis? Why were Reform rabbis more objectionable than other non-Orthodox clergy? And he says this is just a sociological rather than hoc factors may have been at work in the RCA's decision. Understand what's going on here. The Orthodox said, we have to leave. We cannot be together in one chaplaincy commission that we've been together now for over 40 years with the Reform, because the Reform are now putting in a woman rabbi who wants to be a chaplain. So Reform male rabbis for the last 40 years are okay. It's only a Reform woman rabbi that's not okay. What's the difference between a Reform male rabbi or a Reform woman rabbi? It's the same problem that they're Reform. But it shows you that the issue that the Orthodox were able to accept, they convinced themselves, they learned to accept non-Orthodox male rabbis, but when it's a woman rabbi, all of a sudden that goes, that's just an abomination. Is that a halachic argument, or is that, that's a sociological argument? That's but this gives you a sense how in the 80s, it was so far removed from Orthodoxy. But you know something? It was so far removed from traditionalist and the conservative movement. What we're going to do next class, we're going to begin, and I'm going to give you the whole history, because we have a wonderful article by a scholar, Beth Wenger, in this, at two giant volumes here, Tradition Renewed, the History of the Jewish Theological Seminary. She gives the great history of the women's ordination movement, and an article just came out this year, and then I'm going to read with you I'll read what Ruth Weiss has to say. What do you think about that neoconservative Ruth Weiss? If you know something about her, I don't think you'd be surprised. But then we're going to read Lieberman's Tshuva. And I think we have to evaluate, is Lieberman really arguing halachically? But and the history behind his response. We have some people listening who I think were even perhaps involved with it. So we have what to do. We'll devote next class to that. Let me take the questions and comments. At the end, I think we'll conclude that what they were arguing so much in the conservative movement about, so how things changed so quickly, the whole movement fell in line with that. But even the Orthodox, if you look at it, we all recognize today, no one would make the arguments that some of these conservative rabbis are making. I mean, Rabbi Joel Roth arguing that for a woman rabbi, she has to take mitzvos upon herself, mitzvos seh shezman grama. What does a rabbi have to do with mitzvos seh shezman grama? It's just that, and Halivni's unpublished responsum. He never published it on women rabbis. So we'll get to all that next class. It exists in the JTS library. He refused to publish it, but I have a copy and I will share it with you. Justin Hornsey says, World War I chaplaincy, the Jewish Welfare Board. But I think, if I'm not mistaken, wasn't it only World War II with Rabbi Leo Young and the Orthodox when they created one joint chaplaincy commission? And Rabbi Shudnow knows. I mean, he was a chaplain. But did you have the Orthodox organizations involved with it early on? Let me know. Well, let me go to the top first and deal with the questions here. So someone says, Pranav Chitrik, the rabbi of Turkey. He's a Chabad rabbi. He travels all over. He did a nice, I don't know, Facebook, but I went on to see. He went to all different places earlier this year in Turkey that used to have Jewish communities. Mel Barinholtz says, Rabbi Arkefet has mentioned many times that the Rav saw what happened to Chaslovich when the communists took over. Yes. So they were there for a few years. Oh, I said Torah Misi. I said, yeah, Heschel's book is Torah Min HaShemayim, not Torah Misi. That's correct. Morris says there's an anecdote about Lieberman looking to make a mincha minyan. When asked about calling Heschel to join, Lieberman quipped something to the effect that what Heschel wants to commune with God, but I want to daven mincha. Okay, that's a typical Litvish thing. In the book by Edward Kaplan, it says that Lieberman had this, as one of our listeners put it, his impish quality, this mischievous quality. He would always give Heschel shishi on Shabbos. In the Hasidic world, that's a big deal, but shishi. But Lieberman pointed out, Heschel's the only one who knows it's a big deal. Everyone else thinks it's a bad aliyah. So they're looking at it and thinking that he's dissing Heschel. So is he dissing Heschel? Because on the one hand, he's giving him the aliyah that Heschel wants. On the other hand, everyone looking at it and think he's dissing him. So if everyone thinks he's dissing him, maybe he is dissing him. That's Lieberman's sort of sense of humor. Ruth says, I always understood the swimming thing being one of Sakaras Nefashos, that the 9 days were bad luck days and drowning is more likely to happen in a pool or lake than on a basketball court. That I don't know about, because we do swim. It's just that we don't swim, we swim instructional swim or swim to cool down. We don't swim for enjoyment. There's lots of things that people say because the 9 days, some people say you shouldn't even travel. But we go swimming in the 9 days. Everyone goes swimming. It's just that they go instructional swim or to cool down. Growing up, it was never told to me that you should avoid going in the water because it's a bad luck day. I'm sure you know, your rabbis did tell you that. So it's different. Rabbi Shudnow says, yes, if you want to know what the conservative movement will do, look at the reform movement away 10 years. So that's what I said. I said it a little later. The thing is, because the conservative movement is being led by its people, its laity, and the laity, in many cases, is indistinguishable from the reform laity. And that's the scholar's Haggadah is a good piece of work. I am so impressed by this Guggenheimer. The fact that someone who's never had a yeshiva education, who's a complete autodidact, that he can translate the Yerushalmi, that he can do the scholar's Haggadah, that he can do that linguistic study of Hebrew. Rabbi Hartman says, I'm 100% correct regarding conservative and kriya, with tearing the garment. These piskei halacha had negative effect on traditional Jews who belonged to Orthodox shuls, but were not that educated. The driving on Shabbat is a classic example in New Bedford, where I was Orthodox rabbi of shul, whose membership were not educated Jewishly, and told me the rabbi said it's mutter to drive, so you are right. Yes, you told that story. Thank you. And Rabbi Shunna says that Rabbi Robert Porter said driving decision was a huge mistake. We spoke about it. We don't need to revisit that. Rivka says that Dina Nyman now leads a shul in Riverdale and changed her title from Rosh Kehilah to Rabbi. So, yes, so she must have gotten the smicha from Rabbi Sperber. But when she began it, I remember she did not have smicha. And when I was hired to be the Orthodox advisor at Brandeis University, at the time, I didn't have smicha. And so there was a whole interview. And before me, a number of the people did not. Rabbi Mark Gopin did, but Aryeh Cohen did not, and others did not. Because what do you need to be Orthodox advisor? You need to run the minyan. You need to make sure everything is done halachically. If there's questions, you can either give the answer, or you ask, or you and you give a shiur. And you're in a college group. And I remember during the interview, because they were only interviewing men, I remember thinking, why? What are they asking me to do? They're asking me to give a shiur once a week. They're asking me to make sure that things run properly. Why couldn't a woman do this job? I remember thinking that it was a little strange. So when Dini Nyman became the Rosh Kehilah, she was deciding, she wasn't counting the minyan, but if she knew more than the other people, so if they had a question, she'd give them the answer. But that was sort of, that wasn't the mainstream minyan. It was sort of bunch of people on the Upper West Side, singles. It's not your mainstream shul. Lots of things happened in these unconventional minyanim. I was in Princeton a few Shabbos ago, and what I saw there happens every college minyan. Dvar Torah. Who gets up to Dvar Torah? 1 week, one of the guy students. 1 week, one of the female students. One of the women students. It's very natural. It happens, and yet all these students, many of them will get married and then move to conventional modern Orthodox synagogues, and you're not going to have a woman getting up and giving Dvar Torah on a regular basis, maybe the scholar in residence. So there's always differences in the minyanim.
the college millennium. Now, Susanna says, Arlene Agos, if memory serves correctly, in the 70s, wanted to be an Orthodox rabbi and had no idea that it wasn't a coincidence that she didn't know any till then. I don't know who Arlene Agos is, if that's related to the Agos, Jacob Agos or not, or and Irving Agos. You know, I gave you the list of the rabbis. One thing I didn't do it from Wikipedia, what's not included there is that Shlomo Carlebach ordained a few women rabbis. And you might want to say, well, who gives him the right to ordain? But I don't take it seriously if you don't want to, but he did ordain a few of them. Baruch says that Rabbi Nid equals Rebbetzin. Tarek Din is a Rebbetzin. Well, she's married to a rabbi, but that's not why she's being called Rabbi Nid. It's not because of her husband. And we can go down the list. We've already done it in the previous classes of the schools, Lindenbaum and Nishmat and the rest of them. And the female teachers are called Rabbi Nid. It has nothing to do with their husbands. Their husbands are not rabbis, but they are rabbanit because that's in Israel, in the modern Orthodox religious Zionist world, they've come up with the title rabbanit. Now, rabbanit doesn't mean rabbi of a synagogue, but it's a title. Maybe it's okay because it's not rabbi. iPad says, do the titles have an effect on pay equity issues at YU? I have no idea. If people have the same title and similar education, PhD, et cetera, can you have pay differences as well? You're protecting this. I don't know. I think it's clear that it's done for the ideological reasons. Incidentally, the Aguda signed on as a friend of the court in one of these parsonage cases because they had to sign on that women can have the equivalent of ordination because you can only have you can only get parsonage if you're ordained. So how do you then give the Beis Yaakov teachers parsonage? So they had to agree that that they have the equivalent of ordination. Did YU appoint Smadar a professor? In what department? Is she a full professor, an adjunct, or associate, or assistant? I don't know how it works there in YU. You have Judaic studies. It's not the same thing. You have the university, and you have Judaic studies. You have people there who teach Torah, like in the college, who are not, they don't have tenure, they don't go through the regular thing, and they're called professor. So I have no idea. I don't know, it's Jewish studies, and I don't know if you have full professor or associate or assistant for these people who are teaching Torah. Again, these are Torah teachers. These are not, they're not like in the regular college where you have a PhD, and then you go up for tenure, and you have to write articles, which are then evaluated by your colleagues. The title professor is given to people at YU. They've been doing this. They were doing this for the men. They've been doing this for the men for 50 years also, who happen to be teaching Torah and let's say don't have PhDs. So they call them for, if they weren't rabbis and they're teaching, let's say in cognate studies, they would call them professor also. But I find it weird that YU can't come up with a title for people whose job it is to teach Torah, not academic Jewish studies. Rishuna says, Ari Yishol has a yoetz in halacha, but that's accepted by the OU statement there says that the people who formulate this document have different opinions about this, but that's not an issue because that's been accepted by most because that's like a feminine sort of thing. So they can do that. What I'm talking about now is women deciding questions, let's say, of Hilchot Shabbos, Hilchot Kashrus. The OU doesn't even deal with this. The OU only deals with clergy roles. What about Psak? We don't have really that much today. I don't think we have any in America. We have in Israel. But I think the OU would have a much more difficult time saying there's a problem with a woman being a poseket, because why not? Let's say she's just sitting in her office and people ask her questions. I think they would have to conclude that that's okay. Even Rav Schachter, I heard him with my own ears to say that there's nothing wrong with a woman deciding halacha. If she knows the most in the shul, then she should decide the halacha. And there's Rabbi Bleich on tape on YU Torah, unless they took it down, in which he said the same thing, that if you don't have a rabbi in a community and the woman knows the most, then she should be deciding the halacha questions. So I don't think that's controversial at all. So how do I feel about Rabbi Miriam Mervis, the post-sacred rabbi, one of the neighbors of Ephrat? This is just my personal thing. It's hard, I think, in a small shul particularly, for a woman to be the rabbi because If you're on the other side of the mechitza, it's so much is happening on this side of the mechitza. It's sort of problematic, I think. But I don't know how this is going to play out. We're at the beginning of this. We're at the very beginning of this. And Yowetzet Halacha Mara says there's a following compromise. Well, the problem thing with Yowetzet Halacha is because there's a lot of dishonesty involved in Yowetzet Halacha. And the people on the inside know this and they've said it. Because with all due respect to Rabbi Nate Henkin, and she's been saying this for years, she always says that they don't decide Halacha. All they do is tell you what the Halacha is. If they have a question, then they ask. And that's not true. Anyone who knows about it knows that there are times when it's ambiguous and they're not asking, they're not calling up a rabbi every time to ask the question. Second of all, why do you have to call the rabbi? If already the Sefer Achinuch says that a woman could be a posek halacha, so why can't she? And the Yowetzet Halacha, I tell you right now that in Yemen, for instance, they never brought these questions to rabbis. It was thought to be unsneostic. So women were deciding these questions in Yemen, in Tunisia, in Morocco. These were women deciding these halacha questions. They didn't have a term, Yowetzet Halacha, but this was the job of a woman. So this isn't really some feminist sort of thing. This was taking place in not the most not patriarchal societies you can imagine. Jews in the Arab world, where this was just thought to be natural, but in centrist orthodoxy. I think the Hasidim have it easier. The Hasidim, you go to the Rebbetzin, she could probably answer the questions. But in the centrist orthodox world, they need to say, God forbid that the woman would actually make a decision. You know, she has to always ask the rabbi, unless she's telling you what is basic halacha. So I think... Yowetzet Halacha, I think, in my opinion, is a bit, it's a little dishonest. I told this to someone very involved, and she acknowledged, I'm not going to say who it is, because she might want me to, but she says, she said to me, you're right, but this is the first step. So I have no problem with women deciding Halacha. From my own perspective, women pulpit rabbis, I'm a little closer to the OU, because just I think functionally it's a problem. And I also know what's happened in the churches and what's happened in the Reform movement. When women, now this might say something about the, I don't want to say the simplicity, but the Neanderthal nature of our men, I don't know, but it is a fact, and we've seen it again and again. When women take over, it leads to an emptying of the synagogue. We've seen that in the churches, we've seen that in non-Orthodox synagogues, it becomes a woman's place. I don't know if this says that men are insecure, and it could be that Orthodox are different, because Orthodox, it's not like Orthodox people are going to go to the golf course on Shabbos. You know, you have a choice between the shul and the golf course. It could be that Orthodox men would continue in mass to still go to shul, even with women rabbis. But I worry that they would feel that it's not a men's club. And again, I'm not saying this is right, but practically, I think many men need to feel like... it's a men's club. And I also think functionally, it's very difficult, at least in the typical Orthodox synagogue, for a woman to run the minyan. In many Orthodox synagogues, the man runs the minyan. In many places, there aren't the men, the rabbi, he does a lot of things. He's the Baal Kori, the Baal Tefillah. I think it would be tough. Rabbi Shunau says that the chaplain's commission endorsed all rabbis in chaplaincy. But I'm not sure. I have to look into this. I think that the Orthodox officially only came in World War II, but I could be wrong. I didn't even know, Morris, that Guggenheimer is a translation of Eov. Hasidim go to Rebbetzins. I've been told by people that many times when there's issues of this sort, that Rebbetzins give instructions. And things. I'm not there. I can't tell you. That's just what I'm told. If I'm wrong, if it's not true, what I can tell you 100% is that in Yemen, in Morocco, and Tunisia, the Rebbetzins, or not even the Rebbetzins, women who were thought to be experts in this sort of thing. Remember, it wasn't book learning. This was the mimetic, the salvation. This was passed down women to women. The whole idea of Maros did not exist in the Sephardic world. There wasn't such a concept. I know when you go to YU today, you take a shiur, they'll teach you this. So they'll teach you all these things, but this does not exist in the Sephardic world. Okay, we'll end with Ruth. Attendance at the Ashkel Minyan would skyrocket if they took on a woman rabbi. There's a question of tznius, Ruth. Also, it's, I guess for, I don't know, I come from a traditional sort of look at that. It's still hard for me. There's a reason why. Let's put it this way. At the Boston Rebbe Shul, the Mechitza is a one-way mirror.
The women see the men don't see the women. And it's, there's something that, I don't know, there's something at least traditional that, at least in the show, yes, women, bank presidents, scholars, all this, in the old fashioned show, that's what I think the OU is saying, that something needs to be kept traditional. And I'm sympathetic to that. And finally, last question, comment. Morris, I'm curious how the acceptance of the women's clergy issue serves as a prelude to acceptance of homosexual unpartnered clergy. That's a good question, and we'll have to leave that to another time. There's a lot of hypocrisy in the Orthodox world on this, because the Orthodox world continuously says that we have no opposition to homosexuality. If you're made this way, that's it. But active homosexuality, that's the issue. But if someone was openly gay, I don't think Schulz would hire a person who's openly gay, even if he's living, as you say, unpartnered life. I do not believe so. And I think that that's an example of hypocrisy in the Orthodox world, because it's the same sort of issue, I think.
Okay. You remember Aaron Feldman's letter from years ago about that, I'm sure, right?
Yes, that's what he said. He said that someone
correct. That's gay, what he
should go into Torah study and the right. Chinuch and all that.
Someone stuff. Who's gay, they should go to a small town, whatever. Yeah, that was okay. Much discussed, but we'll have to leave that for another time. By the way, you read Samuel Hellman's book, Who Will Lead Us? You see the Rebbetzins were very powerful. These Rebbetzins behind the scenes, the Hasidic world were often much more powerful than their husbands.
Yeah, but here we're talking halachic matters.
No, I understand that. I understand. But I'm saying I think they do overlap a little bit. But okay, there's much more to discuss on the women's issues, I think, and the women rabbis. Yeah. But we'll continue. Thank you very much. Look forward to next week, and look forward to seeing everybody. Tomorrow, Rachel Sharansky Danziger completes her series on Genesis, relationships in Genesis. That's at 11 a.m. And then at 2 p.m., Jeremy England continues his series on science and the Torah, scientific approach. And that's tomorrow, 11 and 2. And then Wednesday night, of course, Dr. Sokolow. Thursday night, Rabbi Bram Weinberg from Silver Spring, Maryland, will be giving the Parsha Shir at 8:30. And then my share in the Siddur at 9 a.m. Okay, looking forward to seeing you. Invite your friends. Everybody be well. And Laila Tov. And thank you very much. Have a good one, everybody.